The Mises Institute assigned me my topic. I didn't suggest it myself. The title of the talk is supposed to be What I Learned from Ludwig von Mises. That title practically invites me to be autobiographical. So that is my explanation and excuse. Back at Oberlin after the war, probably in Oberlin College, probably in 1957, I just happened by accident to come across a couple of little books by Mises in the college library. One was Omnipotent Government, the other was Bureaucracy, a little book which I highly recommend. It explains the logic of coordination and guidance of decisions within a profit-making firm by price and profit considerations. In a bureaucracy, which is not a profit-seeking organization, that can't work, and there has to be bureaucratic supervision and rules. He's not sneering at bureaucracy. In the military, probably, it has to be run as a bureaucracy. In some libraries, maybe they don't have to be run as nonprofit institutions, but they usually are. And the logic of managing them is quite different from the logic of managing a profit-seeking firm. In an antitrust course at Oberlin College, I got only a C. My excuse to myself is that my answers on the final exam were probably too full of ideas of Mises and probably of Hayek also. I knew that Human Action would be published in late 1949, and I was eagerly awaiting its appearance. I knew that there had been an earlier German edition, National Ökonomie, but the Auburn University Library, the Columbia University Library was up where I was a grad student then, didn't have it. But by chance, I had a couple of hours to kill before an appointment in Princeton, New Jersey, and I found and was able to read for 2 hours skim through a copy of National Ökonomie. So I knew what I was waiting for when Human Action came out, and I bought it as soon as it did come out in September of 1949. In 1949-50, I was a one-year instructor at Texas A&M College, now university. I had interrupted my graduate study. It was in between my MA and my PhD, and it was a very worthwhile experience, I think, but that's another topic that I won't get into. What I do get into is that I gave a faculty seminar and at Texas A&M, and my topic was the socialist calculation debate. I was well aware of the literature at the time, and certainly knew about Mises's writings and knew about Hayek's The Use of Knowledge in Society, 1945. I, well, have been arrogant enough to reprint that talk unchanged in Is the Market a Test of Truth and Beauty, in order to show how early I think I understood the topic. And I could talk with Joe Salerno about the question of whether the use of knowledge is a big element or not of the difficulty of socialist economic calculation. But perhaps I'll leave that to him at some other time. I taught a course in general equilibrium theory at the University of Virginia for several years. And the idea of general equilibrium theory, at least as I understand it, is how different sectors of an economy hang together, how technological possibilities, how tastes in some sectors radiate around and influence prices and output in all the other sectors. And I found it extremely useful to use the socialist calculation material to get those ideas across. Back at Columbia University to finish my PhD, I had the courage to write to Mises and ask if I could meet him. And he very graciously wrote back and said I could. So my graduate school roommate, Ken Waltz, and I paid a visit to Mises at his apartment on West End Avenue in New York. I was eager to ask him lots of questions about his ideas and some other ideas of economists that I admired. One of the economists that I asked him about was Wilhelm Röpke, R-O-U-M-L-A-U-T-P-K-E, who was something of a disciple of Mises. They had been colleagues for a while in Geneva in the mid-1930s. Certainly, Mises was familiar with Röpke's ideas. Röpke was a very good economist. I could get into some of his works, especially his little book on the real basics of economics. But what impressed me was his, well, humanitarianism and his wide range of knowledge, his humanitarian policy instincts, rather romantic. And I asked Mises what he thought of these ideas. And he said, oh, well, they would be fine if, before they are put into effect, Professor Röpke give us a list of people to be shot. I too, was rather surprised at that answer, but his explanation was, well, in the kind of society that Röpke has in mind, and he had the Switzerland of his ideals in mind. He was German, but had to leave after Hitler and move to Switzerland. The idea of people working in the daytime in clean little factories, not big messy industries, working in clean little factories, coming home after work to putter around in their gardens where they grew their own vegetables. And Mises's point was that with that degree of deindustrialization, it would not be possible to support the current population at anywhere near the current standard of living. Rather than let lots and lots of people die miserably, slowly of stagnation, it would be better to shoot them. So let's have the list. Mises got into talking about the dishonesty of leftists. I'm sure he knew lots of them and their characters. And I was prompted to ask, but aren't there any honest leftists? He took the question very seriously and pondered for a minute or so, and then came up with the answer, Gottfried Haberer. Now, if any of you are acquainted with Gottfried Haberer and your work, you know he was nowhere near a leftist. Of course, he was another one of these economists who had been influenced by Mises and who knew him very well. He was just a little bit, well, maybe considerably less to the so-called right than Mises himself was. Haberer was a really dear man. I got to meet him on several occasions. While I was a grad student at Columbia, I had the opportunity to take a two-week seminar with Mises at Washington Square. It was not connected with either NYU or Columbia University. It was a voluntary presentation by Mises himself. His topic was monetary theory. And I think it is there, although what I learned there was probably a reinforcement of ideas I had gotten from Mises' writings, but he certainly reinforced my idea of monetary theory, the logic of the quantity theory of money, not interpreted as some mechanical relation, but the logic of the quantity theory, how the quantity theory affects the price level and relative prices, and the logic of personal power parity doctrine. The key idea is that there is such a thing as a demand for cash balances to be held and a quantity of cash balances, money, to be held. And what happens if the quantity demanded and quantity supplied are not equal? Well, that's a big question at the center of monetary theory. The distinction between quantity demanded and quantity existent and in existence, the question of whether or not we've got monetary equilibrium. I posed a question related to that to my professor of monetary theory, James Angel at Columbia. What do you make of what happens when the quantity of money doesn't equal the quantity supplied? He simply didn't understand the question. He had never been acquainted with the distinction between actual and demanded quantity of money. All money that exists must be demanded because it's being held voluntarily. Well, being able to make the distinction that Mises did is central to understanding monetary theory. I got some insights into methodology from that seminar, but I will save remarks on them until later. A person I got to know at this monetary theory seminar was Bettina Bean, later Mrs. Graves, who followed Mises around and, as far as I could tell, was writing down everything he said. And she continues, last I heard, at an advanced age, furthering Austrian economics and knowledge of Mises' writings. Mises and I exchanged Christmas cards for a few years. I don't claim to have been a friend of Mises, though that would be arrogant. I would just say we were pretty well acquainted. Oh, did I mention that other exposure I had to Mises was in a couple of Volcker seminars held at Buckhill Falls, Pennsylvania. 2 week, quite a long seminar, each one having three main speakers. And Mises was one of the main speakers at one or two of those. So I got to learn more of his ideas there. I was at the Institute for Humane Studies, then in Menlo Park, California, in the late 1970s. And at that time, Louis Spadaro, who was one of the early resurrectors of the Austrian school, showed me a Xerox copy of Nation, Staat und Wirtschaft, which he had gotten somehow or other, Mises' book of 1919, and asked me to look through the Xerox and see if the book was worth publishing. Well, I said, yes, it was worth publishing, and I wound up being the translator, published in English in NYU Press 1983, and now in a new printing with the other Mises works published by the Liberty Fund. I got some help, supposedly, at somebody's suggestion, from Mrs. Mises, visited her at her apartment a few times. Mises, by then, was dead, and I'm afraid I didn't get much help out of her, which leads to some meditations about translation. I won't go into all my meditations, but one is this, that it's much more important to have a native speaker's command, or the equivalent of the language being translated into, than of the language being translated out of. The book I'm talking about had a lot of historical content, as well, of course, as economic theory interpretations of what was going on in wartime. It was published, as I said, in 1919, a few months before Keynes's Economic Consequences of the Peace, which I also think was a great work. Keynes was not a scoundrel. I think his theory in the general theory was wrong, but he was not a scoundrel. And he and Mises had basically the same ideas, that a vindictive peace would be inappropriate. Mises' recommendation was that the Germans, for that part, not seek revenge, not to try to punish in some way or other their former enemies, but to continue trying to make a peaceful, prosperous economy. Well, that's it, a large overlap between the ideas of Mises and Keynes. The book that I'm talking about, Nation, State, and Economy, had a lot to say about the background of World War I, and a lot to say about why democracy didn't really flourish in Austria or in Germany. It was the mix of nationalities, the mix of native speakers of different languages who would be quarreling about, like, say, what language should be the language of instruction in a particular school. And in his book, he makes lots of historical allusions, mostly to the Holy Roman Empire and then the War of 1866, German Empire established in 1871, the great multiplicity of petty states in the Holy Roman Empire, which continued in reduced numbers in the German Empire of 1871. I think it was a rather picturesque situation. They had a unified money, the marks, but the different kings, grand dukes, princes that had states and petty states within the German Empire could put their own faces on the coins, something like the euro coins today. Well, anyway, he made so many historical allusions, which probably made sense to his German language readers of 1919, that I realized they probably wouldn't make sense to current English-speaking readers, so I wrote a fairly lengthy historical introduction to the book, trying to clue the reader in to what Mises was alluding to. Another thing I got out of the book was the importance of language and the role of language in determining nationalities. What is the best way, if you want to classify people by nationality, what is the best way to classify them? It's not necessarily where they live. It certainly is not a matter of biology. It's a matter of native language, or in any case, language in which they do the great bulk of their thinking and reasoning. Before the War of 1866, well, Germany referred to German-speaking territories. A German was an inhabitant, a native German speaker of German, mostly German territories. And Austria was counted as part of Germany. In fact, it was one of the two leading states in Germany before the 7 Weeks' War of 1866. Mises ends his nation-state and economy on a utilitarian note. He doesn't think socialism could bring peace and prosperity, but if he could be shown, if it could be demonstrated that socialism was the best system for mankind, then being a good liberal and a good utilitarianism, he would accept it. Factually, of course, he did not think that socialism would bring these good results. But that clues me into his comments on utilitarianism. I think I derive my basic ethical, or let's say meta-ethical ideas from Mises and writers whom he inspired, notably Henry Hazlitt, and writers from whom Mises had been inspired, David Hume. He did not have the latest, at the time he was writing, latest philosophical refinements in mind, the distinction between act utilitarianism and rules or indirect utilitarianism, but he had the basic ideas of utilitarianism in mind and was pretty contemptuous of mystical ideas of what the foundations of morality were. By the way, The Foundations of Morality is the title of a very good book by Henry Hazlitt, writing under Mises' influence and giving ample credit to Mises. Some of my papers on Mises' ethical ideas, philosophical ideas, are included in this, is the Market a Test of Truth and Beauty? Now then, for methodology. Mises mentioned methodological questions in his seminar at Washington Square, but more, of course, in his writings. One thing that came up, though, at Washington Square was a painstaking econometric study of the market for watermelons. And his point was that not one point of economic theory would be shaken at all if there were no such things as watermelons. As for econometrics, well, he didn't use it himself, and I am not sure that he would even have approved of it, but he did make the valid point that there just are no constants in economics. There is nothing in economics durable and precise as, say, Avogadro's number or the different atomic weights and numbers, or the speed of light. That what you are really learning, well, econometrics can be useful as a tool of historical research, obviously. And what research intended to pin down the parameters of the current economy, parameters of the economy that could guide, say, policy making, know what the multiplier, if there is such a thing, was. At best, they are researches into recent economic history. Don't kid yourself into thinking that you're pinning down the very structure of the economy. Now, in connection with Mises's methodology, he has often been accused of pure a priorism, and indeed he does talk about the a priori character of economic theory as such, and not talking about economic history. The term a priori is somewhat wobbly. It has slightly different uses by different people, but one of the interpretations, and one the critics of Mises made, was that he was trying to derive propositions about the real world from pure logic alone. That would be in violation of one of Hume's forks, or sharp distinction between logical propositions on the one hand, which are true by their very meaning, and empirical propositions, which have some content of observation of what goes on. In other words, he is in effect accused of trying to derive propositions about the real world from logical truisms like if A implies B, then B implies not A, or that all bachelors are unmarried, which is true by the definitions of the terms, or say there are 143 prime numbers, no more and no fewer, in the range of 100 to 1,000. That follows from, even though it seems like an accidentally precise number, that follows from the very definitions of numbers and prime number. Well, Mises was in effect accused of trying from pure logic to get propositions about how the real world worked. Well, Murray Rothbard cleared that up in his In Defense of Extreme A Priorism. Rothbard puts extreme a priorism in quotes to suggest a question about whether it really is extreme a priorism. Mises didn't mean that you can derive factual propositions out of pure logic. What he really meant, at least on Rothbard's interpretation, which I think is correct, is that the kinds of empirical fact that are basic to deriving all the theorems of economic theory are such immediately obvious facts constantly pressing down upon ourselves, that we can't even imagine how they would be otherwise. For example, that people act, that people try to make their situation better as they conceive of it, or that there is more than one factor of production in existence. We could go over a somewhat longer list of these undeniably obvious empirical facts, but these are facts that you could come to just by sitting in your standard term is armchair. So Mises's economic theory is really based on empirical fact, exploited, of course, with the aid of tautologies. Tautologies are very useful in economics. Logical reasoning is very necessary in economics. Mathematics is a tissue of tautologies, yet very useful. History is important, as Mises emphasized, but it is distinct from economic theory. Mises certainly did not scorn history. He has lots of allusions to it in Nation, State, and Economy. He did his doctoral dissertation on landlord-peasant relations in Galicia. Galicia was where he was born. Lemberg, then so-called, where he grew up, was in Galicia. It's now moved around and found itself in Ukraine, as Lviv. By the way, for this sort of fact, and others about Mises's work and movement to the United States, experiences in the United States, Guido Hilsman's biography is a magnificent work, an exciting read, a huge piece of work. I wonder how anybody could accomplish all that. Mises was blunt and forthright in his doctrines. He didn't believe in shading what he was saying to appeal to a wider crew, to have a tinge of political correctness to what he was saying. In other words, he followed the advice of Philbrook. Not that he was getting his ideas from Philbrook. Philbrook had them already. But Philbrook has a nice article on realism in policy espousal. I think that's AER December 53. Is that correct? And the idea there is the very immorality of concealing what you really think as an expert when you are giving advice, that it's wicked, let's say, to give advice to policymakers adjusted to be politically more realistic, to give a better chance of getting adopted. He was rather contemptuous of economists, Philbrook, for big reputations built on their circulating around in policymaking circles. What could be legitimate, and what also W.H. Hutt explained in a book on the subject, is to make it perfectly clear what you think is best as an economist, and then to point out that some second best policies would be acceptable as such, if politically necessary, to get the policies adopted. But remaining maintaining perfect honesty about what you think as an economist. Mises wrote and spoke English clearly and fluently. His style had certainly evolved toward simplicity since he wrote Nation, State, and Economy in 1919, which was full of the long, long, compound, complex sentences considered characteristic of German professors. But he, through his career, gradually simplified his language and wrote really very remarkably understandable and clear English. I don't really understand the idea that human action is a hopelessly complex work. It's big, it requires paying attention, but it is clear. As for his English, it's sort of funny that although he was perfectly fluent in writing and speaking, he still retained a pretty definite accent, pronouncing question, say, as question. Now, a recap of the main ideas I learned from Mises. First and most specifically, monetary theory and the importance of distinguishing between actual and demanded quantities of money. The importance of recognizing the consequences of monetary equilibrium and disequilibrium. And then I think I learned from him the logic of peaceful cooperation in a market economy. Competition and economic life in general are activities rather in contrast with the price theory that I learned as a grad student at Columbia. I remember shortly after getting my PhD being depressed because the world just wasn't like the pure and perfect competition described in the textbooks, the static equilibria described in the textbooks. I later realized that these can be useful as tools of reasoning or maybe tools for blackboard exercises. I don't condemn them, but certainly they are not the core of economics, and economics has to include large doses of the action that Austrian economics emphasizes. I also learned about interventionism and the economic, the consequences, unintended consequences of particular interventions. And of course, the importance of a utilitarian basis of morality in personal and political life. What Mises says in Human Action bears on the concept of homo economicus, a term, you know, coined by analogy with biological classifications. Mises quite rightly points out that this concept is unnecessary and counterproductive, and yet some people consider it necessary to conduct economic theory. Last I heard, Buchanan thought so. The idea is that we, in order to be able to form neat economic theory, we have to deal with an idealized man who is concerned only with the pecuniary motives, trying to get money and spend money to serve his own best interests in that rather narrow, financially oriented sense. Well, Mises recognizes and intends his economics to be descriptive of how real people work in the real world. Sure, people have lots of tastes that are not to be gratified, cannot be gratified by purchases on the market, lots of motives. They are not narrowly self-interested as the mythical Homo economicus is. They can have even very altruistic motivations, using altruistic in a more common sense than the pejorative sense in which Ayn Rand uses the term. He even talks about the devoted nuns who practically sacrifice themselves to serve their fellow man as they conceive of it. Not that he was religious, but he would take as the example purely other-centered people as part of the great complex of humanity that we encounter. All we need for economic theory is to recognize that pecuniary considerations are relevant for everybody, no matter what the purpose might be for which you wanted, say, to spend your vast income. If you could achieve it, you still would try to make profit and avoid loss. Increases in prices would discourage you from buying things and encourage you to sell things. The whole logic of how the price system and profit and loss, and of course private property, tie things together does not depend in the least on the supposition that pecuniary motives are the only thing that that drive people. Decisions in response to monetary incentives are perhaps the main focus of economic theory, but economics well recognizes that people respond to other incentives as well. And I would also like to point out Hayek's contrast between the extended order, the great range of persons and businesses that deal with each other through purchases and sales, prices, profit and loss, who couldn't, because the range of their cooperation is so vast, they simply couldn't deal with it on a personalized basis. But things are different for small, intimate groups, members of families, members of particular causes, maybe even members of particular little religious sects. Such groups have an intimacy to them, a nature of interrelation among their members, quite different from the arm's length dealing in the extended order. And we don't want to try to impose profit and loss price considerations. We don't want members of a family to charge others in the family in money for any little particular service they do. That would crush the spirit of the small intimate groups, and that certainly is necessary for a healthy society. It takes all kinds of people and all kinds of groups to make a healthy world. All kinds of people except scoundrels, of course. Now, reviewing what I've learned from Mises doesn't imply that I stopped learning from him. I repeatedly dip into human action again. I learn on reading existing works, newly published works. Now, I'm going to spend a little time toward the end, because I want to leave time for discussion, on a kind of sermon. Don't take any particular school of economics as gospel, as truth, where all the other schools are heresy. And that goes for the Austrian school as well. Don't consider everything else as heresy. I don't think it's a good idea to imagine a struggle between neoclassical economics, standard economics, whatever you want to call it, and Austrian economics. Ideally, the best ideas of Austrian economics would get incorporated into mainstream economics. After all, in the past, say in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Austrian economics was clearly part of the mainstream, and we could hope that that happens again. As grad students, I think you ought to learn standard economic theory, even if you have lots of objections to it. If you are going to do battle with it, you have to understand it. You have to understand what the other people are, where the other people are coming from. And I think likewise goes for econometrics and math. You may not think it has much use, but other people do. And as long as you're in the profession, and maybe especially if you want to turn things around, you've got to know what you're dealing with. So I'm pretty much making a confession. I'm not a hardcore, card-carrying member of the Austrian school. Once in a panel, I replied to a question from the audience, "What school do you belong to?" And I had to reply, "I don't belong to any school. I'm a fellow traveler of the Austrian and Chicago schools, both, if that is possible." And Fred Clay, another member of the panel, chimed in. "Yes, it is possible, because I too am a fellow traveler of both those schools. I have doubts about some of the details of Mises's and Hayek's business cycle theory. I have the happy impression that these dubious details are not being emphasized as much these days as they at one time were. We can all agree that excessively easy monetary policy does harm, and we've had recent examples of that. So too does a contractionary policy." Well, mentioning a contractionary policy brings me back to my remarks about Ripke, about whom I had a conversation with Mises in Europe in his apartment, if you will remember. He was a very good economist, and I could recommend several of his books, but he had an article early in the Great Depression, published in the Festschrift for Gustav Kassel in 1933, on the secondary crisis and how to overcome it. In other words, regardless of how the world has got itself into this depression, it has deteriorated into a secondary crisis. It's become a self-aggregating deflation, which doesn't cure anything and causes misery, and we just don't want to stand back and let it happen. This is time for some monetary expansion, time to check the monetary deflation. Thus, from a disciple of Mises, writing as early, or being published as early as 1933. Well, anyway, as a monetarist, I surely recognize all the harm that too much monetary expansion or monetary contraction can do. But I, preaching again, think that we shouldn't start with the preconception that money and interest and their effects on investments are necessarily and always the core of the business cycle story. Cycles are specific historical events. They are episodes of blatant discoordination in the economy. And I think that's the best way of understanding prosperity on the one hand and depression on the other hand. Prosperity is a well-coordinated economy where the plans of the different participants mesh together pretty well, whereas a depression is a discoordinated state of affairs. The most obvious example of that is that you've got here workers who would gladly become bigger consumers if only they had the incomes to spend, if only they could find jobs. And we have employers who would gladly hire more workers if only they could find customers for the additional output. You've got their potential customers for additional output, potential suppliers of individual output, but they can't get together because the coordination through the price system has been disrupted. It could be conceivably a bunch of inappropriate price and wage ceilings and floors. It could be also the fault of the monetary system, too much or too little quantity of money to accommodate people's desire to hold money in view of the transactions that they would be doing. Because after all, money, although demanded to be held, is held precisely in order to be able to spend it when you want. So cycles are specific historical events which should be researched with historical techniques, yes, and with the aid of economic theory. You simply can't, and every good economist recognizes that, certainly the Austrians, that you can't conduct historical investigations without some kind of theory to guide your investigations. And we should have an ample toolbox of theory to deal with historical events that we're trying to explain. I had gotten into a friendly controversy conducted by email with Adrian Revere, or Ravier, or however you pronounce it, an Argentine economist who was later, or maybe before and after, studying with Jesus Huerta de Soto in Madrid, Huerta de Soto being one of the other heroes of the Austrian school. And he said in one of his emails that obviously I didn't understand the distinction between theory and history, that it's illegitimate to try to explain events, including business cycles, otherwise than by theory. And of course, he knew what the correct theory was. I replied, and he recommended that I straighten out my thinking by reading Mises's Theory and History, a book that I was already well acquainted with. So that was my reply to his student, Ravir, that you've got to recognize that business cycles are specific historical events. Certainly the one that we are now in or trying to crawl out of is a specific historical event which has a lot of specific events, including the real estate situation, in its background. Well, with my reply that the distinction between theory and history did not escape me, that I was simply contemptuous of applying theory to denying that I was simply contemptuous of applying theory to try to understand episodes of depression, that was the end of our email controversy. Okay.